Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. And today we'll be talking about visionary photography with Michael Rauner. And I met Michael a number of years ago when I started doing a book project on the history of alternative religion and consciousness movements in California. And I was having a bear of a time trying to figure out how to tell the story, because I was trying to tell it in a linear way, you know, a conventional history book, start here, chapter there, 7, 8, 10 chapters, something like that, and it just was not working out. And one night, very clearly in my mind, I got a vision that the book needed to be heavily illustrated with remarkable color photography, and that it would take the form not of a linear history, but of a journey through the landscape of California, where the stars, in some sense, would be all of these places that captured the stories that I was interested in, theosophical society headquarters that had turned into some apartment condos, or Scientology buildings, or the San Francisco Zen Center, just all of these buildings that somehow captured this story, or these many stories. And I was incredibly lucky, because the editor that I had been talking to at Chronicle Books, I needed to get a photographer, and he was like, well, I know this guy, Michael, you might really hit it off. And I went to his website, and it was like, yeah, this could work out, right, ever, you know, seems pretty good. And then we met, and he went out and photographed a couple sites, and it was just totally extraordinary. It was more than I imagined, and it went on to become an excellent, excellent collaboration. Not only did Michael do a remarkable job of capturing the peculiar essence and sort of spiritual ambiance of a lot of these amazing, many forgotten buildings and churches and temples, but he really infused a great deal of kind of intimacy and enthusiasm into the project. And I learned a lot from him. I had never done a lot of photography myself. I mean, I like photography, but I hadn't really grokked it, really. And I remember early on in the project, we were hanging out and talking about photography, and he talked about how it was a very hedonistic thing in a good sense. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, the appreciation for light, you know, for when that moment is ripe, when the light is right, when the shadows are right, when there's an ambiance in the air that you can literally capture on a photograph. And I was like, what? And then by the end of the project, I know exactly what he means. And so sometimes when I'm enjoying, just like when it's that perfect moment, I often think about Michael, who infuses a very intense sense of the marvelous into his photography, as well as a great sensitivity to people and places. So the visionary stay was a really big deal for me, and it also led me to meet our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maju Dau, who I first met at a little book party that I gave at the old Farrell House, and then we went on to meet her, to do more work with her when I did a bus tour of Los Angeles, visiting some of the sites covered in the book, and now she does similar tours herself. So it's the visionary state day here on Expanding Mind. So how you doing, Maja?
I'm doing good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. So you still do those bus tours, right?
I totally do. I just did one not too long ago. We went around to all those places, and, you know, it's funny. They are like these older buildings, some of them that people might have forgotten about, and they're like these treasures in Los Angeles, and like your book showed, all over California. And one of the things I loved about your book and Michael's photography is that they really bring them to life, and you see how these things are living entities kind of tucked into all these corners of forgotten spots in California.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about the photography, you know, we're sitting here praising Michael before he comes on, but as a lot of his work is portraiture. He's a remarkable photographer. You know, some people have that gift of drawing out something both really special and also really intrinsic and essential about people when they photograph them. And in a lot of ways, he brought that same sensibility to the images of the buildings, because buildings have character. They have their own personality. They have their own essence and their own kind of those elements that are captured only at the right time or from the right angle. And it really helped to give a lot of character to the book. And people listening to this can check out some of the images, even if you don't have the book, on visionarystate.com, and you'll see a couple handfuls of Michael's photographs, as well as some text. But enough talking about it without being here. Michael, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you. I'm assuming you can hear me?
Yes, we can hear you A-okay.
Perfect. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to just ask, since we're talking about the visionary state, I'm curious for you what you learned about your craft, about photography, in terms of that project, and you could talk a little bit about some of the things that you had been most inspired by before that led you just to your interest in the visionary state. But I'm really curious, like, what you took away from that very long process, very rewarding, a lot of work went into it. But I'm really curious about that.
It's been years, Eric. It's great, actually. That's a really wonderful question. Every project that I take on teaches me something big, and usually it takes a few years to figure it out, like anything. The thing with the visionary state is that I started really shooting and building a book, kind of the visual skeleton of a book, as I was in the field taking pictures. And I'm using the kind of the same technique that I did with Visionary State with you on other projects that I'm currently working on, and that is I made a kind of image outline, an image-based outline, because really, if you remember, I mean, when we started this out, it just flipped all my switches. I was extremely excited about working on it with you, and we were kind of working not exactly as mountain climbers linked together, but oftentimes on parallel tracks, where you would be writing something that maybe I already photographed, and some of my photographs would inform your writing, but more often you would have written something that I would go then investigate as a photographer, and I would kind of shoot into your writing and find the things that you would write about and try to illuminate that in an image. And then after building this big chapter outline, it really got me into thinking about how books can be built, you know, in either verbal outlines or image-based outlines. And so that's a big part of my life, is making these books, and it was a great project to build that kind of discipline and structure.
Well, let's just talk about those books a little bit, because, I mean, that was one thing I didn't even realize when we started off, is how much that for you, for a long, long time, photography has also been about the idea of a photo book, of a collection of images, perhaps with text, perhaps not, but as a way of organizing images. What is it about the book form that you think opens up something within photography, or what is it that draws you to that book, the book collection of images?
Well, we're going to have to go way back to my, you know, early teenage years in San Diego, where we shared a little bit of a background, you know, at least us both being from the Southlands. But I was really a literature kid, and I ended up getting a degree in college in literature. So books have always been kind of a driving passion, and just working as a narrative artist. I was also a really big photo enthusiast from memory. And so to make a grotesque oversimplification, a lot of photography kind of fits in, at least a fine art photography, fits in kind of two different categories. One would be like, you know, a poetic image where they're individual little jewels that do their thing. And then another one, which is a slightly more traditional one, is, you know, being a narrative photographer. And that's really what I am, as a storytelling photographer. I've ended up taking that into more sculptural forms, where there's kind of less narrative, and I make a book of images that imply something nice. Really traditional, almost more documentary projects. And so, books and photography and storytelling, that's my earliest memories and desires. That's what I do.
Well, one of the things about the stories you like to tell, at least some of the projects you've done, is that they have a very interesting religious dimension or spiritual dimension. And that was another thing where it was such a blessing to meet you, because you had, in some ways, a similar kind of life history. You were interested in similar kinds of things, and you were also drawn to both aspects of traditional religion and then aspects of alternative, Burning Man and paganism and other kinds of streams. So what is it about religion as a photographer? What is it about the religious or spiritual impulse in people that attracts you?
That's another tough one, man. That's a hard question. I think that just like, I feel like photography kind of chose me in this weird way. I don't ever remember deciding that I wanted to be a photographer. I just would always be stealing my parents' camera. And then I ended up doing yearbook and just kept doing it. So I don't ever really remember having any choice about pursuing different subjects, about being a seeker either, kind of the spiritual path is a curious one. And I grew up in a fairly traditional Catholic household and a very traditional Catholic elementary school. And that would be enough to drive me away from the Holy Ghost forever. However, it didn't really. And some of the things that I love about being Californian and being a photographer, it all kind of intersects for me around subcultures, oftentimes spiritual, esoteric, or outsider artist-based environments, and telling a story about them and what that story tells about kind of a greater story about California and the American West is just what I'm interested in.
Well, that's a good lead off to talk about your current project that's up right now at the Doug Adams Gallery at the Bade Museum in GTU, which is a part of Berkeley, their Pacific School of Religion, and it's a collection of photographs of Witch Camp. So why don't you tell us what Witch Camp is, and what a little bit about the project and images that people would see if they're able to get to the show.
Sure. First, let me just mention the show a little bit. It's a two-person show. And in fact, I am showing photos of a new project about contemporary neo-paganism, and specifically this retreat called Witch Camp, which is in Starhawk's reclaiming tradition. Starhawk actually started these camps a few decades ago, probably a little less. And they're now throughout Europe and the United States, Canada. And it's a very specific tradition from reclaiming. And so I'm showing some photographs that I'm still in the process of working on. I've been photographing there for about 4 years. And I was contacted by a curator at the Doug Adams Gallery there. And she had recently acquired a marvelous portfolio of work by Mark Thompson, who had been photographing radical fairies from their early days in the early 80s. Mark Thompson is an incredible photographer, mostly an author, and he got into photography through this. And so, literally, the work is up at a esteemed but little-known jewel in the Graduate School of Religion. It's a museum of biblical archaeology. And so half of the museum is full of 3,000-year-old Old Testament artifacts from a specific site that was excavated by this guy, Bonte. He was an old professor at Berkeley in the 30s and 20s. And then the other half of the museum is pictures of radical fairies and witches. So it's, I think, probably the only time there's been such a combination of work. And it's really a delightful show. It's up until August 26th at the Bonte Museum. Let's see, more about Witch Camp. Shoot me another question.
Sure. Go ahead, Maja.
Oh, I was just going to say, like in the show, did you notice any kind of stream or narrative between the juxtaposition of the biblical objects and the witchcraft stuff?
Wow, I think just being soaked in that remarkable combination, that all holy vibe, is the main part of it, because the context, especially because this museum is kind of, it used to be a library, but literally it's shaped like a stone Gothic chapel with flying buttresses and arc giant windows, sweeping windows and everything. On one hand, you have these really ancient little oil lamps and urns, and then the portraits that Mark Thompson and I have done were actually juxtaposed very intentionally. Very unusual to mix, you know, black and white and color photography, or to mix photographers' work. But Karen Jacobs, the curator at CARE, did an incredible job where she would pick these images that Mark Thompson did 30 years ago, and then she curated a collection of images that I made and kind of matched them up. So there's almost an uncanny visual echo going on between our two works. So that's really where the main play goes on in this kind of ancient, sweeping and steamy, because it's quite warm because of all these windows, context at the Biblical Archaeological Museum there.
Well, one of the interesting things about your project is that, having myself done research with neo-paganism and been in the kinds of subculture environments that also, you know, interest you, are, you know, whether it's like, you know, psychedelic freak culture in India or traveler culture or Burning Man or whatever, is that one often finds, particularly in the scenes where there's some kind of spiritual or ritual aspect, a great deal of resistance to photography. And I'm sure that part of your process with Witch Camp wasn't just a sort of whatever aesthetic one of, like, you know, figuring out the best shots or what I'm going to take a picture of. It was also very much a social process of you kind of entering into the community, of allowing people to become comfortable with you, and then even seeing the way in which photography could be a way for them to express their particular spiritual work or their particular view of the world. And I know that that's part of what attracts you to a lot of these scenes, is actually getting into the kind of social dimension of it. I mean, with Visionary State, you would often go to places that I went, you'd come back with all these great stories because you'd met the groundskeeper and he knew the person and all this stuff. So there's a very much of a social aspect to your work as well that comes through with the intimacy and the character of the people. But in the case of Witch Camp, it's a real specific situation because of the history of paganism and how it's been perceived and how people are kind of reticent about a lot of photography. So how did that evolve?
Another great question there. With Visionary State, you know, it was a little different because I was going to communities that were not a part of my personal life experience or kind of, you know, spiritual makeup, or I was a stranger in a lot of these environments. And also I was a stranger with a giant backpack with a big Hasselblad and a tripod, and I would kind of have to haunt the place for a while and maybe return at a different season, and I'd have to get in touch and get permission and explain what we were doing. And so that was a very different social process than something like Witch Camp. Witch Camp is just one place. It happens 1 week a year. And I've been years-long friends with many of these people I've known for over a decade, including a lot of the core administrators. Reclaiming is part of my spiritual makeup. It's definitely one of the communities where I feel home. And I never would have considered photographing it because reclaiming rituals have had a very explicit and ongoing tradition of having no photography whatsoever. Since the very, very beginning, back in the ancient year of 1979, this is a new tradition, there was a lot of documentation. But, you know, back in the 80s, if someone were to be outed as a pagan, more specifically as a witch, there were some real serious and quite negative consequences that could happen with custody battles, with job promotions, with even with family politics and family dynamics. So photography had been fairly prohibited, and then explicitly prohibited in any kind of reclaiming ritual for decades, really. So the reason why I started even thinking about photographing at Witch Camp was because about 4 years ago now, Starhawk contacted me and invited me and two other really great photographers, Richard Mann and Michael Starkman, to document the annual spiral dance that happens here in San Francisco around Halloween. It's reclaiming's largest public ritual. And I'll go out on a limb. I don't know this as a fact, but I think it's the largest public pagan ritual in the United States. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm like you. I can't say that with 100% accuracy, but I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, they have a gigantic hole in their history. It's an unrecorded history because it's been prohibited to record it. And, you know, there's been people, important people in the reclaiming tradition who've either suffered strokes or who have passed on. And this first generation living memory is lost, you know. So there was always a consensus process in reclaiming. They have a specific cell, a specific group of people who take care of the annual spiral dance ritual, the spiral cell. And it was brought up that perhaps they should select people from within the community to document it. And I wasn't around for this conversation, but apparently it was a long one before consensus was actually reached. And once it was, it seems to really not be much of a deal at all. There's quite a bit of discretion involved with photographing in a place like this, especially at Spiral Dance, because it's so big, and I don't know most of the people there. I tend to photograph people who I know only, who know what I'm doing, know my intentions, and are totally open to it. Some people certainly would not want to show up in a photograph because of their lives are separate. And some people just like to keep their spirituality private. That needs to be completely respected. But especially in the case of, like, you know, witches and radical fairies, it's kind of a slightly edgier scene for some parts of this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Although it is really changing. You know, it's a remarkable thing that I found out that in the military there are pagan chaplains, and even on gravestones, for military gravestones, you know, how they will put a Star of David or a cross, they'll put a pentagram.
And yeah, I've read that recently also. That's been,
and I'm like,
in,
wow, that is something.
Really big,
I mean, that
New
is
New York Times, National Stories about that. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it just shows how these alternative movements sort of find their way in. And you know, and on the, you know, at first thought, you'd think of the military as being the last place you'd see that, because I associate anyway with kind of conservative values and this and that. But on the other hand, when I started to meet people who are in the military, and people, particularly people who don't have a lot of options, and it's like the best thing for them to do for whatever reason, there's a lot of pagans in there. So it's very interesting how these, where and how these groups come up. But for you to, you know, photograph and then bring that into the public eye, what are the qualities or the moments, the faces, the events, the particular character that you're interested in or conscious of sort of bringing through to a more public display?
Well, I'll tell you one moment that was really nice to happen a few years ago. As it just so happens, Witch Camp usually wraps up around the 4th of July. It's kind of a summer solstice thing, at least in California. Different camps in different parts of the world have their different weeks when they meet. But here we are in Mendocino Woodlands in California on the 4th of July. And I remember a ritual where, you know, freedom of religion and our founding fathers and all these wonderfully patriotic things were evoked. And standing beside me was a young woman from Connecticut. And, you know, people on the East Coast tend to have a little bit more of the proximity to the founding fathers' level of, you know, patriotism and the national mythos than people in California. Visibly affected, really emotionally impacted by this notion of freedom of religion, and that it was evoked in a freaky witch ceremony out in the forest of California. And that really struck me. I thought,
well, it's,
you know,
interesting,
what
too,
more patriotic?
I mean, if you put that
to dance
in,
naked around a fire in the woods,
you
be able
can
to
just
be free
suppose
to do that,
that, you know? With George Bush, you know, Jr., who made the statement that witchcraft and paganism is not a religion. He made a public statement that paganism and witchcraft was not included as a religion. And I've had many people say that to me as well. So I know, you know, as Eric says, there's still a lot of progress being made. And that idea of patriotism and freedom of religion, I mean, I personally have faced repercussions just from coming out as using the word witch to describe myself. I've been asked to remove it from my website. I've had all kinds of familial, work-related, and political situations that have come up just from even saying that word. So when you say, like, one of the reasons for privacy was out of respect. It's literally out of fear of instigating a witch hunt, which continues to happen to this day. There was that governor, I think he was in Alabama, who made a public statement also that any witches were no friend of Christianity, and that would be, he literally said they would be publicly persecuted in his, you know, in his vicinity if he ever found out that anyone was practicing witchcraft. So, I mean, it's no joke. So to be able to have something, like you said, to have people feel a freedom affiliated with a ritual, and to be able to have that kind of coincide with patriotism, even in the face of, you know, people like presidents saying that it's not patriotic, that it is, you know, satanic and booyah like that, it's amazing to me that people are still able to participate in that and have that feeling of freedom and patriotism.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And it's true. This conversation was touched upon actually at a recent talk at CARE, at the show there in Berkeley at the Graduate Theological Union. And the photographer who I'm honored to show work with, this guy Mark Thompson, said they actually had a system back in the day for radical fairies who didn't want to be photographed, and maybe people have their point and shoot cameras out. Now, this was back before Facebook and digital cameras, where pictures can spread very, very quickly, of course. So it wasn't actually as big of a deal back then. But for a while, some radical fairies started a tradition where they would tie a yellow band around their arm. And that meant, don't photograph me, or don't, you know, include me in a photo. Because it's really quite serious. At Witch Camp here in California, you know, the first year I went actually as a cook. I wasn't a camper. I have friends in very many different parts of camp there. And then the second year I went, I made a big presentation about my intentions after getting the support from the administration and of the camp. And I have a little ritual before I photograph anyone. First of all, the style of my photography is usually very direct. It's impossible for me to do the kind of pictures I want without the full collaboration of the person I'm photographing. I don't do candid pictures.
Hmm.
But on top of that, I have a little ritual called a model release. and it's partially, just to keep it extremely clear that my intention is to show the work publicly. But also it's a moment to sit down with somebody and let them really reflect. I'm like, okay, am I ready? Is my life in a situation that can support being publicly viewed as a witch in this totally pagan, freaky place? And for a lot of people, many, many people have told me that it's been a radically transformative experience just standing in front of a photographer who's an artist and a professional photographer with this intention, and to say, yeah, I'm ready to own this. And not everybody is. So I have a lot of different types of ways that I do portrait work. And a lot of them don't include a face. There'll be a portrait from someone's back. It'll be a truncated portrait, or their hands, or holding an important object like a journal. So there's many ways to do portraits and to maintain a private identity. But the act of stepping out really brightly into a public position as a witch has been a kind of a important part of the project, and one that I don't approach lightly.
I'm curious how your own, since you've had, you know, experience with paganism and rituals, and you know a lot of the people, was there a way in which that particular kind of spiritual ambiance or set of cultural desires and images, did it affect the way that you were photographing, like how you approached the situation, what kinds of things you were noticing, what kinds of things you were drawing out in contrast to other projects that you've had with subcultures or other religious scenes?
Absolutely. You know, and that's the most fun, is not knowing what you're doing when you start. And that's the challenge, of course, also. But over the years, you know, I'm not just a photographer there. You can't do this kind of work and not be it. So with pretty much all the projects that I do, there's a very strong personal tie-in. You know, my seeking spiritual path is plural. And it includes a lot of seeming contradictions. I'm still Catholic. It's still part of my makeup. I'm not very much a witch. So it's kind of, you know, I'm also a lot of other stuff. including a skeptic. but my work at camp there moved from kind of the landscape, which is awesome California redwood forest with a history of being one of the most intensely harvested timber areas in the world. You know, I mean, these ancient redwood giants were all cut down in the 1860s. And then in the 1930s, when the second growth was kind of up again, there was a kind of all these camps were built for recreation purposes. But when we're out there at Witch Camp, we're surrounded by these gigantic stumps. They're stumps the size of a shed or a small house. And then the young little trees are enormous. And so I was really taken by the landscape at first and was working with the modifications to the landscape. It's kind of the enchantment of the campsite when people are there and they do kind of earthwork or sculptural stuff. But, you know, over the years, I became more and more interested in the people. And it feels like at this point, the project is really a portrait-based project, which is a really big part of my my love and my life, both as a commercial photographer and as an artist. So.
Hey, Michael, I'm just going to interrupt here. That sound is a sign of our break that we're talking, that we need to take. And this is Eric Davis on Expanding Mind talking with Michael Rauner, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're speaking with Michael Rauner about witchy poo stuff. Michael, before you break, you talked about something and how you're a Catholic and a witch and all these things together. And to me, it's really important to have that come into people's minds, that it's not like a segregation. And I mean, I'm sure if it's Starhawk behind the witch camp, she's not about trying to segregate witches from the rest of any kind of ideology or spirituality. And one of the reasons I became a fan of Starhawk, even when I was in high school, was through her ecofeminism, which was advocating, you know, not a feminist reaction against patriarchy, but a kind of assimilation. And it's so funny because even at the show of yours, just including the biblical stuff with the kind of witchcraft stuff, I think it's really important for people to assimilate it and put it together. And it seems like with a lot of your photography work, that's kind of what ends up happening, is this kind of assimilation into including all these things together and mixing them all up into kind of a big soup. And I'm just curious, like, do you find that because that's happened to you as an individual with kind of merging these philosophies, that that's why it's becoming reflected in your work that way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's as an individual, as an artist, and I think distinctly, and this is one of the main points of the visionary state with Eric, was that kind of as a Californian, I mean, it's a little bit of a cliche, but there are so many different influences here that it does, there's a particular Californian-ness that I definitely have. The part about these Abrahamic traditions, I think, is important. You know, the Bade Museum is it's literally an old Testament site that was found through biblical archaeology. They didn't really know if this place even existed or where it was, but they used the Bible to help them find this site and excavated all this marvelous stuff that was incredibly intact. You know, Starhawk, of course, grew up in a Jewish tradition. And I think a lot of pagans actually kind of come from Abraham, actually. It's not a problem with me. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that whole sense of a particular kind of California spirit, I think, also marked us both, like whether or not you're from or live in the state, that one of the ways that it functions in our imagination, and in the American imagination, and particularly the religious imagination, is both a place of, you know, kind of experimentalism and even a kind of absurdity sometimes which is totally overt from the people who are doing the absurdity. One could think of Burning Man here as a particular example, but more deeply and more profoundly, a kind of sense of the possibilities of genuine pluralism, of a sense that the world of spirit too doesn't have to be superficial if one is interested in multiple perspectives and in multiple practices. I mean, you often find people both from traditional religions and even from, you know, new religions that they've discovered, like they've decided, or, you know, gotten into Zen Buddhism, and they'll be like, you know, at some point you have to, like, choose a path. And you know, that is, unless you choose a path, you're always flitting around, and you're not getting down to brass tacks, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that, you know, there's definitely some truth to those critiques, and there's certainly a lot of people who get lost in eclecticism. But I think there's also something else going on, another way of being with spirit, another way of being with tradition, that has to do with allowing contradiction, paradox, your own personal history, your own family history, and your own interests, even passing interests, to sort of inform one another and create a kind of collective sense of things. And that was, I think, something that motivated both of us. But I'm curious, just in your own history, how, you know, whether you were in high school or later, did you start to sort of, you know, both step away from your Catholic upbringing and open up to these other spiritual zones? But even more so, how did you kind of realize that in some ways you were still a Catholic, and that was still a living part of your spirit and your the way you saw the world?
I don't know. I kind of see origins, either religious origins or geographic or political origins, as being inextricable. Like, I can leave the United States and go live in Spain. I'm married to a Spaniard, and I did that once 20 years ago. But I'm still an American in Spain. You know, I could leave the Catholic Church, but it's still pretty indelibly imprinted. In fact, you know, some of these contradictions or seeming contradictions don't appear so at all to me. In fact, I wish they were a little bit more contradictory. There's so many parts of the Roman Catholic Church that I find abhorrent, and I'm certainly not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I don't have any problem showing up for a Mass in the right time and place. Right? I welcome that. You know, I grew up in the Roman Catholic Church of San Diego in the 1970s. Post-Vatican II, you have all these folk masses and liturgical dancers. And if you've been to a reclaiming, especially styled ritual, it looks a lot like some Southern Californian Catholic churches in the 70s, where there's an embodied improvisational thing as part of the otherwise traditional ritual.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I know a magician, you know, a very deep, long practicing ceremonial magician, who was when he was a young man a Catholic around, you know, in the late 70s. It was, you know, the era of a kind of revivalism, a kind of Pentecostalism, if you will, inside the Catholic Church, that manifested as in a lot of a more kind of ecstatic, everyone involved sort of rituals. And he still says, though, that the most intense ritual he's ever been in was at one of these mass gatherings, even though he's completely, you know, rejected the whole ideology. And this also kind of links up a little bit with your project on photographing Guadalupe when you went down to Mexico City, because, you know, it's when you're in that situation with this amazing goddess who's, you know, the most worshipped goddess in the Western Hemisphere. It's so redolent with paganism, both in terms of the origin story of Guadalupe and then the folk practices, and yet it's also at the heart of the kind of Catholic imaginary in Mexico and throughout the world. That must have been a very interesting experience for you. When did you do that?
Well, actually, I started in 2003. I was visiting my dear friend Adriana Camarena and in Mexico City, and wanted to go make the pilgrimage to Tepeyac. And I had a little plastic kind of arty Lomo point-and-shoot camera, and I made some initial pictures that I really loved. And then actually right when we were wrapping up the visionary state, as kind of a little send-off, take a break, I scooted down to Mexico City again to visit her, partially because we share this enthusiasm for bullfighting, which I'm sure a lot of people wouldn't be able to fit into this context, but there's another lead for that. But I was photographing Guadalupe and looking at how photography was really used in this synchronized religion. It's really an Aztec Catholic hybrid. And being photographed at the pilgrimage site, pinning photographs to altars, really is a huge part of the cult of Guadalupe. And I just love her and it. The school that I grew up in was a very Latino neighborhood. And we have, Guadalupe on the side of our building. That's always been kind of an inextricable background goddess in my life, from taquerias to churches. And going there was very special. It's not casual, and it's not Catholic. The Catholics get very bent out of shape when you say that. But whatever. It's a pagan, ecstatic, crazy ritual. If you go there on December 11th, the night before December 12th, which is her feast day, it blows away any other experience, like Burning Man, craziness, whatever. You know, this is real. It's so intense, it's scary. You fear being trampled, like some other ecstatic religious rituals in other parts of the country. Everyone's very friendly, of course, but it's rapture.
Yeah, I have to do it at some point, just from hearing you talk about it, and I too have really, really resonated with that figure, and I noticed her a lot. But it's interesting when you think about her story, that how in a way it's kind of a myth of photography. I mean, what is the Guadalupe? The Guadalupe is partly this image that appears on this humble burlap. I can't remember the name. You probably
Tilma,
do.
The Tilma, San Juan Diego's Tilma. It's just a little poncho, very rough.
What's it made out of? It's like really coarse material.
Right.
Like it's something that the peasant would wear, and then suddenly it becomes the image of the goddess, and that's the image. It's not like everybody can make up their own image of Guadalupe. It's like there is
exactly
an icon of Guadalupe,
exactly,
that is that image. It's a very interesting kind of spirit photography, almost.
Totally. And the way it was revealed was kind of like photography in its magical way, where the goddess on the mountain told the peasant to collect the roses, and after many struggles he finally revealed them to the bishop, and he thought that the miracle was the out of season roses, but the miracle was the imprint. The roses stained his rough poncho with this very esoteric and very complex and very precise image of Guadalupe. There's only one image of Guadalupe. There's 10 billion images of Jesus, but there's only one of Guadalupe, because it comes from that image, which has survived against all odds and is revered today with great passion.
Well, that's great. And there's so many things you've done, but we cannot leave as we approach the end of the show without mentioning Leonard Knight and Salvation Mountain, another site that we did for the Visionary State. And I don't remember whether I wrote about it before you went out there. You went out there first. I know you went out there many times because you kind of fell in love with Leonard Knight in that place, and it's a remarkable, wonderful place. And so tell me how that evolved. I mean, you ended up going there many times, and that became sort of part of your own personal spiritual topography.
Yeah, not kind of fell in love. I completely fell in love with Leonard Knight, and the first time I went, I think, was about 2004. And literally, it was one of these times when I stumbled out on my truck and the sun was setting because I was behind schedule, whatever. It's hard to get to. And everything was perfect. And I was looking for Leonard to try to meet him, to tell him who I was and what I was doing and my intentions and all that. But the light was so perfect, I couldn't find him. I just started taking pictures. And actually, the main picture that ended up in the book, I did in about 2 minutes. So I was pretty much done for all practical purposes. But I wasn't, for personal purposes, and I returned to Salvation Mountain at least once a year, oftentimes several times a year, ever since. I don't know how many times I've been there. Last time I was there was December, and I'll be back again in November. The mountain is not doing well, but it is a vision. It is I want to recite Kubla Khan when I think about Salvation Mountain. It's just
I realize we didn't really introduce it very well. So can you explain it a little bit? That was my fault too.
What's that?
No, just if you could explain it.
Yeah, Leonard Knight came from a Pentecostal tradition, One day, the vision came from Budweiser. I don't know if you know that, but he was out there in Illinois and he saw a giant balloon floating across the sky advertising beer. And he thought, why doesn't someone fly a balloon that says God is love? That's been his guiding message. And so he spent like a decade or more working on this balloon, trying to stitch it. And it became like a parable, because by the time he was nearly finished, part of the fabric had already rotted away. It took so long and he didn't really know what he was doing. And one of his last efforts to try to get it to lift was out there at what's now Salvation Mountain at the edge of Slab City. Slab City is kind of a off the grid, a permanent autonomous zone on the site of the former military base, Fort Dunlap, where Patton trained the Marines for the invasion of Tripoli back in World War II, and then abandoned it because it's such a godforsaken place. In the summer, it goes to 120 degrees, and most people either have to leave. Some people who can't leave literally die there. Leonard's been living there for 27 years without electricity or running water. There's a little hot spring and a reservoir, and he built this earthship. Salvation Mountain is it's a folk architectural style of straw bale and adobe. The straw bales are placed like bricks, the adobe's the mortar, and then by painting a skin on it, it keeps the water out of the adobe, and he's built these kind of igloo shapes, the largest of which is massive and will never be completed. It's incredible, and it's held up by all these sticks, put in car tires and packed in with mud. These branches kind of hold up each kind of adobe piece, and if you imagine a giant psychedelic painted bright colors igloo made out of straw bales and paint, you're starting to approach it. It's a phenomenon.
Well, one of the remarkable things about him too is that there's something about his Christianity that is not like things that one encounters very often. There's a sort of it's so intimate, it's so personal, so basic, so right there, that you feel that the fact that whatever you believe personally doesn't really play a part in the connection that you're having with him and with this place. And I mean, to me, it's the best example. It's the most moving example of folk art, if you will, that I know. Maybe partly because it's so reflective of him and that very peculiar energy that's something that comes up in America. I mean, there's this real, I mean, there's folk, religious-inspired folk art everywhere, depending on how you define it, but it seems to be particularly a character of American Christianity that it can produce these sort of visionary geniuses who are really just not, they're just not interested in a lot of the framework that surrounds art or the religion, and they're just out there in this kind of singular passion. It's a very moving story.
It's true. Although Leonard's an incredible talker, and if you saw the John Penn movie Into the Wild, he has a cameo and totally stole the show. He told me later that when he met Sean Penn, he's like, okay, I'm happy to do the movie, just don't tell me what to say and don't tell me to do it again. So he just let it rip. And he'll talk your ears off. He's wonderful. But he always says, I'd rather let the mountain do the talking. I've got a bunch of pictures of it up. My site is michaelronner.com/salvation_mountain. It's a small portfolio of the work. And the mountain literally can be read. It's filled with biblical scriptures and passages with the core theme of God is love. He says that's all you need to know.
And then are you going to do, we talked about books before. I know you've done all sorts of photo books over the years with different projects. What's on tap for now? What are you working on in terms of building books out of these wonderful projects?
Well, thanks. I make a lot of books. You know, a lot of them are handmade. They're oftentimes oversized in the 20 by 30 inch kind of category, and literally we'll make prints and glue them together and do a hand-bound kind of sculptural object. But as narrative books, I do hope to have either, a trade edition book of some of these bigger projects, especially like Salvation Mountain and Witch Camp. But I also do print-on-demand books, and I make a lot of those. It's pretty remarkable new technology. And you can see a lot of them on Blurb. I hate to plug them so shamelessly, but they actually do quite a good job. And they have a bookstore. You can search for Rauner, R-A-U-N-E-R. But I'm working right now on a couple of projects that kind of are more in the tradition of Leonard Knight, in that it's a portrait not only of the phenomenal space that he created, this visionary landscape he built, but it's also a portrait of the man, of Leonard Knight himself, you know. And so photographing artists and their work is another big part of what I like to do. Oftentimes, it's like with Leonard, it's an artist doing iconic, sacred work. Not always. I'm working right now with the Art Commission, the San Francisco Art Commission, on a book that Heyday is going to put out next year, in part in conjunction with their 80th anniversary, photographing public art in San Francisco. And through that project, I was given an opportunity to put in a proposal through a sister city of San Francisco, which is Shanghai. And they accepted my proposal to go and photograph some contemporary artists like the remarkable San Juan, who made this multi-headed and multi-armed monolithic copper Buddha that was in San Francisco's Civic Center last year on a temporary loan. Really incredible work being made out of China, contemporary art up there. And so I hope to, I will be in September in Shanghai photographing contemporary artists, and that's going to be a book that the city of Shanghai is going to put out, me and about eight other artists from around the world who have these sister city relationships to Shanghai. So it's a little bit of boosterism for the good city of Shanghai, and it's going to be a great opportunity to visit China and to meet some contemporary artists there.
It's kind of a big deal, too, that, like, artists are able to do religious art and get it, like, kind of accepted and supported, huh?
Well, especially this piece. You know, this piece was actually modeled after destroyed Buddha statues that were...
Oh, the ones from...
Some of them were the ones
totally.
Blasted by the Taliban, and other ones were blasted by other equally unaccepting traditions.
Wow.
And so these were the broken Buddhas. And so he reassembled them into this kind of Buddha dervish, where there's six arms are kind of supporting him in this kind of, you know, spinning cycle with three heads on top. And
that's epic.
35 feet high. It's beautiful. A really, really wonderful artist and a great piece. And yes, it's a big deal to do religious art in China. You know, you can't really do that so much.
So. Yeah, that was a remarkable, remarkable piece. I mean, it was just, and one of the things about that, you know, Salvation Mount is another example of like, okay, we can call it art, but it doesn't capture it all. I mean, that's one of the great things about religious art is it's not just art, even though you can experience it as art and appreciate the image and be moved emotionally the way you would with secular art. There's this other dimension or multiple dimensions, you know, mystical perhaps, but also ritualistic, also a claim about reality that has a little bit more weight to it, and it's not always clear exactly how you're going to respond to it, and that's part of the wonder of it. I mean, you can go to Salvation Army and go, oh yeah, let's go look, it's interesting American folk art, and then you meet this guy, and suddenly you're like, wow, this is like a landscape of the spirit. This reminds me, I'm walking through my dreams here, or I'm walking through my childhood, or my the first time I heard the gospel story, or whatever, you know, can happen to you in that, and that remarkable piece by, I'm terrible at Chinese pronunciation, but Huang, was like that too. You know, here you are, it's like the Civic Center, it's like the center of San Francisco, you know, city power, and it's this, it almost asks you to circumambulate around it, and people would move around it, and people would meditate under it, and they'd bow to it, and they'd take photographs of it, and they'd eat their lunch by it, and it was just remarkable for opening up a religious space without saying, hey, this is religion, you have to treat it like religion, because it wasn't really coming from that perspective, and it's in a way it's symbolic of a lot of the things that we've been talking about this whole show about that interface between art and art and the spirit.
Yeah, like a lot of great art, a lot of people also hated the piece. And in all respect and apologies for my equally terrible Chinese pronunciation, the artist's name is Zhang Huan. If you want to look him up.
So people hate it. What didn't they like about it?
What don't people like about art and religion? I mean, I heard some people got bent out of shape about it, man.
People got bent out of shape. Yeah, they probably were like, oh, the city shouldn't be putting in pieces like this, and da 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 da.
I thought there was that argument. I think some people just didn't like it. I mean, but possibly, you know, similar to Salvation Mountain, which is on the lip of an abandoned military space, which seems to be fairly ambiguous land. I don't know, it's not BLM land, it's sandwiched between the Salt Sea and the Chocolate Mountain bombing range, but it have a religious
Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind, michaelrauner.com. Best of luck in Shanghai and your other other adventures.
Great, thank you so much. The show at CARE is up until August 26th at CARE_GTU.org.
Wonderful. Well, from me and Maja, keep your minds open.